Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thank you so much for taking out a subscription. We love you for it. Today, I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello. This week, we'll be talking to RRR director S.S. Rajamouli about a possible sequel to that amazing film. Plus, we'll be rating Timothée Chalamet's cannibal love story, Bones and All, family animation Strange World, Weinstein takedown drama She Said, and musical Matilda, and the supernatural drama Nanny. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, Neil? What have you been doing? Have you been to any film festivals?
Well, last week I had the pleasure of going to the Marrakesh Film Festival in Morocco. And let me tell you, if you get the chance to go to enjoy some desert heat in November and get away from the rain and the misery of the UK, definitely take it. I had a very enjoyable time. I saw some interesting films from all around the world, including some a film you saw, I think, in Venice, Master Gardener, yes. Paul Schrader's drama, which I think was enjoyable. I had some reservations with it, but I thought the acting was very strong. I saw a French drama with Isabelle Huppert called The Sitting Duck, or La Syndicaliste, as it is called in France, and a film which I'll be writing about for the magazine called Godland, which is an Icelandic drama set in the 19th century. But most of all, I had a very nice time in the sun.
And did you have some nice food there?
I did. I had a tagine. Yum. Which is fabulous sort of communal stew, which they put on the table and you just feast to your heart's content. Mm. And it was a very, very enjoyable and a nicely run festival. And I was delighted to be able to attend.
Lovely. Yes, I didn't see The Sitting Duck in Venice, but that was also at Venice, I believe. So yes, The Master Gardener is an interesting one, isn't it? Great Sigourney Weaver, though, right?
Yeah, it's kind of, she's so strong in the first half hour of the movie that when the story sort of moves away and she's less on screen, I think the film kind of suffers as a result. But I thought Joel Edgerton had that kind of strong silent type that Paul Schrader writes, very similar, obviously, to Oscar Isaac in The Card Counter, which we spoke about on a previous podcast. Although I would have appreciated more Sigourney Weaver, I think the film is an interesting sum up of many of the themes that Paul Schrader spent a lot of his career exploring.
Yes, indeed. Well, we'll talk about that in more detail on a future podcast, but for now we should probably talk about what we can watch this week. So, Neil, how do you like your meat? It's this.
You don't think I'm a bad person?
All I think is that I love you.
You look like the kind that's convinced himself he's got this under his thumb. But you pull on one little thread and
I'm ready. My lord. Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. You want it darker? We kill the flame.
Love will set you free.
So this is Bones and All, Luca Guadagnino's, reteam with Timothée Chalamet after Call Me By Your Name. Not remotely the same, though, is it, Neil?
No, it's a left turn, I think you could call it. Comparisons, I know you made it in your own view on the website, to Twilight and to that sort of supernatural kind of romance. It's basically, it's about cannibals in love, effectively. There's a young woman called Marin, a teenager, who realizes that that these weird urges that she have is basically she likes eating flesh, and she is forced to sort of go on the run or go on a road trip in order to sort of find herself and hopefully her missing mother in order to get the answer that she is seeking for her condition. Along the way, she meets a very peculiar cannibal played by Mark Rylance and a very sort of young and lustful cannibal played by Timothée Chalamet. And together they go on a kind of Terrence Malick road trip through the Badlands and Heartlands in America. And along the way, they discover themselves and also why they have this peculiar and very bloody compulsion.
Mm. So, I mean, I spoke to Timmy and to Luca and Taylor Russell, who plays Marin at Venice, and they sort of talked about this film as saying, it shouldn't be viewed just as a bloody cannibal film. It's about connection and people connecting to each other and people who are on the fringes of society finding a way to their sort of tribe. And that particularly during lockdown, this was a lockdown film made with very few people, that this might speak to audiences on a different level. Does it work on that level for you, Neil? Or is it just, you know, people eating people? There are some quite in-your-face eating scenes in this. Does it work on that level? Or, you know, are we not quite managing that?
It is hard to get past the grisly horror context in which this tale of young lovers is explored. When you basically have a scene of Mark Rylance crouching over an old lady who's basically just who's recently deceased, and he's feasting on as blood is dripping down his underwear and his vest. It's really kind of hard to think, how charming. There's more Suspiria, I think, than the other things that we know the director for. You know, obviously, Call Me By Your Name, that recent TV series he made, We Are Who We Are. This feels pretty much rooted in its horror context, to the point that I don't really feel that it's gonna kind of be a breakout hit. As much as people are going to want to see Timothée Chalamet in his sort of kind of fashionable dreads and kind of like, you know, his odd hair that he has, that and his very kind of charming, raffish kind of outlaw sensibility that brings to this character. Taylor Russell, I think, is great. Mark Rylance is very odd. and there is another actress who appears, who is a regular with the director, who appears later, which is a quite a nice surprise. Particularly,
little spoiler, no spoilers.
Yeah, particularly in the way that she appears and the contribution she makes to the story. As much as he'd love to think it's a movie about young outsiders, it's really a horror movie about flesh-eating cannibals.
Yeah, no, I agree. This was, you know, greeted rapturously in Venice when it played there, and the fans for Timothée were very rapturous about him being there in his blood red outfit. But I found it quite difficult to get past the sort of grubbiness of it. And that's intentional. This is, you know, a Reagan era film. This is set in sort of, as you say, the badlands of America, where stuff is very run down. People are hard scrabble, and these people are on the run, and they're not living a great life. It's a fearful life. It's a sort of dirty life. It felt that I couldn't get to the beauty of their romance through that for me, and the bloodiness and the violence. And I do find it quite difficult to find it romantic to murder people who you've preyed upon. It's murder. You know, you have taken someone from a fairground and slit their throat in a field, regardless of what weird rules you've set up about how you do that. So it's very difficult for me to get to the love part of this. However, I was swoony over the soundtrack and the visuals. I mean, this really does, it's about big skies and long open roads and Americana, isn't it? So from that point of view, I found it very beautiful to look at, but it didn't really touch my heart.
Yeah, the music by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross is great. Yeah, like you say, the visuals have this sort of like this majesty, putting these two people against the kind of the epic landscape of the American heartlands. Whereas I suppose Twilight, in this film, there's the same correlation between cannibalism and sexuality, that it's basically, it's a turn on to eat people. And there's Michael Stuhlbarg, also from Call Me By Your Name, turns up, and he has this speech about if you eat a body, bones and all, then that's the kind of the height of the experience. For me, I would think it would be the height of indigestion, but in this world, that's the sort of the height of the cannibal experience. I don't know, it's hard to get past the thoughts of Anthony Hopkins in his jail cell and the horror tropes that come with this. It feels like an odd fit to try and graft a sort of swoony teen romance onto this rather grisly and indigestible scenario.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's quite interesting what they've done in casting Timothée, because obviously in the book, his character is a bit more gung-ho, a bit more of a jock. And in bringing Chalamet in, he brings that sort of softness and that delicacy that he's known for, and that sort of his wearing his heart on his sleeve. So this does feel much more tremulous and sort of delicate, a love story, than perhaps it might have been. If you're looking for that from Timmy, you're going to get that. And along with his, you know, sort of, as you mentioned, his look, which seems to be made up of the victims that he's eaten, because he wears sort of various blouses and cardies and things of possibly people he's devoured. Nothing matches. It's all very sort of grungy, which again is, you know, if that does it for you, it's really going to do it for you. Taylor Russell for me was the revelation here. She's great in Waves. We saw her in Waves and she was wonderful in that. But her sort of yearning for a place in the world, I felt, was really tangible. And the softness of her voice, but that she's also completely feral. I think she managed to walk that line really beautifully. But yeah, Mark Rylance, for my money, another funny voice.
Yes, and he sort of speaks himself in the third person. His name is Sully.
Sully.
It's never Dully with Sully. And his role is Taylor Russell's first introduction to the way of the cannibal, you know, how cannibals can apparently smell each other. And also they can smell when life is about to end and there's basically fresh meat on the slab for them. How he goes from that to being this sort of constant presence in the story strains credibility. To the level where he keeps on recurring, and you think, what, do cannibals also have a sat-nav? I mean, just that he always knows how to put exactly the right place. It's a very peculiar, and I would say rather undirected performance. I think he was allowed to just get away with anything while the director's sort of eyes were on other things. And although it's a very colourful performance, it's slightly out of kilter with the rest of the film.
Yeah, it's very showy, whereas everything else is much more muted and small and delicate, and his is, here I am doing my acting on a grand scale. So yeah, I agree with that. It sort of doesn't sit well within what everyone else is really doing there. And as you mentioned, you know, Michael Stuhlbarg, that's quite an alarming scene to see Elio's dad, Papa Perlman, who we had seen in Call Me By Your Name, doing this beautiful speech with Chalamet that people have taken to their hearts. This is very different, isn't it? This is almost like Luca Guadagnino and his troupe of actors taking Call Me By Your Name and just blowing it up and doing the exact opposite with this film.
It is. And it's hard, in a way, to miss a certain cast member from Call Me By Your Name who is not here. And if you have been reading the stories, maybe he should be here. But that's an element of, adds a sort of weird real world context of the film and sort of like, you know, like a sideline to it, which is a bit strange. Timothée Chalamet is able to, I mean, he says at one point he's 140 pounds wet. You know, he's not the most muscular or buff kind of actor in this. He's very sort of like, he's waif-like and waif-thin. The fact that he's able to overpower people and sort of take people into a position where he can sort of take advantage of them and obviously sink his teeth into them. Again, it's rather incredulous to me. He's called upon to do things in the film that I don't think he would be physically able to do or logically able to do, if that makes any sense.
But then we are talking about eating bones and all in this. You can't eat a person's skull, bones, femur, rib cage, the whole shebang and all. Surely a person can't do that. So should we not be taking this as purely supernatural and metaphysical?
You're probably right, and you've given it a lot more thought than I have about the actual the nuts and bolts of it. But I guess it's a metaphor. There's something lacking in them. Maybe they're lacking heart and soul, and that's why they go out and they get it from other people. It's just weird when for them to treat this weird sort of cannibalistic community and give it this kind of, if you like, poeticness, and yet still have the graphicness of the characters ripping skin off dead bodies and having gore kind of plastered over them like it's some kind of scene from Carrie. It's a weird mix. I don't feel it's a terribly successful one, but I think if you follow Timothée this far, you'll follow him.
Oh yeah, I think Timmy fans will be very happy with it. It's just the sort of thing that he might do and continue to do something completely different again for his next project. It is difficult when you're talking about this and saying you can't sort of get beyond the gore of this, but then I'm okay with Interview with a Vampire. And that's what I'm kind of confused about in myself. And maybe that says more about me that, you know, I'm fine with vampires killing people. Why? Maybe it's the actual grubbiness of this, the sort of ripping apart. Vampire, you get a little suck in your neck. You have a little orgasm as you die, it seems, from Interview with the Vampire. People are like loving it. Maybe that's fine. I don't know. I don't know what it says about me. And then maybe that's the point of this film. that how you choose to interpret it, how you view it, what questions it makes you ask is the point of it. Maybe that's it.
Let's just say it's an acquired taste.
Ba-bum. Nice, Neil. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Bones and All, it is out in cinemas on Friday. And I would say it's the sort of film you should see on a big screen because it is gorgeous to look at. It's swoony, the visuals of it. Definitely worth seeking out on a bigger screen. Right, before we get on to our next film, shall we have a listen to what the director of RRR, S.S. Rajamouli, had to say when he sat down with our very own Jack Shepherd yesterday to talk about all things RRR, including a possible sequel.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you because RRR is one of my personal favourite movies of the year, and I know it's been one of our team's favourite movies of the year. And it really feels like a breakout moment for yourself within perhaps the Western movie world. You've done other big blockbusters like Bahubali series, but this really feels different, like it has some real momentum behind it. Do you agree with that? How's it feeling for you?
Absolutely. Thank you, Jack, first of all. And for me, from my perspective, is there any difference between my previous films and this? No. But from the reception point of view, obviously the kind of reception RRR was receiving from the Western world is totally unexpected. Absolutely love it, no doubt, obviously. Yeah. But I'm still in the process of figuring out why or what exactly is that the Westerners are liking about RRR.
What's your current theory on why we're all enjoying it so much then?
I wouldn't be able to nail it exactly. But one thing I would definitely say is that because of COVID, as we were locked up, people started watching stuff from across the world. So I think in general, the audiences have opened up to various cultures, various types of filmmaking. So the general reception of the audience has increased across the globe. That I would say is one thing. Second thing is, like, again, this is what I gathered from the people who loved RRR and why they said they loved RRR, is that unapologetic heroism.
It's definitely been likened the most perhaps to the superhero movies and the Fast and Furious films as well, very much. Do you see a shared fabric between your film and those films?
I love those films. I watch yes. almost every one of them. Obviously, all the human beings, we love to see fantasy stuff. Fantasy in the sense of humans being able to deliver some superhuman abilities. We love to see that. We love to hear stories, such stories. One thing I think that is predominantly different in RRR is that the characters don't possess any supernatural powers. Their characters itself, themselves, are very rooted, and their emotions are very, very human-like, what we feel. And in that aspect, it is like any normal movie. But when they are driven by those emotions, is they do things that are not possible in regular circumstances. I think that is the small difference.
The characters in this movie, Raja and Beam, are just fantastic. They're both on kind of their own revenge missions against with the backdrop of the English Empire in India. And where do you draw the line then on something being too fantastical and staying grounded? Because, I mean, it must be quite a thrill to write on the page, Beam throws a tiger at an Englishman. Mm-hmm. So where do you kind of draw the line there?
It is very difficult to exactly describe it. I think it would be a very instinctive decision whether to do some stuff or not. I believe more on concentrating about pushing that character's emotion at that point of time. How important it is for the audience to believe that this character can do anything to achieve what needs to be done. And basically the audience should be receptive to see what this character is doing. Then you can really push the character to do superhuman things. But if you ask me, like, how do I draw a line? It is very difficult. It is just that instinctively, yes, this can be done.
I've been reading about how you created these action sequences and how you kind of create the an hero image with a concept artist first, with everything down to the details of the blowing hair and everything. It just sounds so meticulously done as well. But with a film that, I mean, we're pushing up to nearly 3 hours long, and there's so many of these incredible sequences, What was perhaps the biggest challenge with this film?
The biggest challenge would always be not losing track of what we set out to do. Like you said, it's a 3-hour long movie and we shot it for about 320 days.
Wow.
Which is a long time, which was spread across because of COVID. Because it's such a big movie on a massive scale, in the process of achieving that, we have to take care of so many nuances, so many small details. In the process of doing that, we shouldn't lose focus on what we set out to do. I would say that is the biggest challenge. From time to time, I would come out of it, go to a bird's point of view and see whether the directions that I am taking are ultimately leading to the goal or not. I constantly keep checking that.
When you talk about a goal and having something set out to do, then what do you mean? Do you mean by you just want to complete the movie, or is there kind of a message and a feeling that you always strive to have with all your films?
Completing the movie the way we intended to do. When the story is written, I really, really get excited about all the sequences, all the scenes, songs, dance, fights, whatever, because I envision them in a certain way on screen. But to achieve that, I need so many technicians, so many workers, so many departments come together to work on one single thing to achieve that. So it is very easy to get lost in that process.
Yes.
So when I mean that we shouldn't lose focus is that what we have written as a script.
Yep.
Delivering it to the audience the way intended to. That is the goal. So not losing sight of that goal is important.
There are many moving pieces in this movie, but perhaps the breakout movie has been the song Natu Natu. Natu Natu Natu. It's so fun. And I mean, I've seen videos of people dancing in cinemas to this. When you're making something like this, do you have that sense of, wow, this is going to be a moment, this is going to be a thing that transcends barriers and is going to have people dancing in the cinema? Can you feel that when you're making it, or is it just kind of happens and takes on a life of its own?
No, definitely we envision that. One interesting theory that I have is like the story is a basement, which we don't see.
Okay.
And the building are the scenes or emotions or Natu Natu dance that we see. The theory that I have is the basement doesn't care about the building. The building doesn't care about the basement. But it is very important for us for the director to get both of them right. Let me explain that a little bit more.
Okay.
When I had Tarak and Charan as actors, because both of them are fantastic dancers.
Yes.
It is only natural that the audience expect there will be a great dance number. That's the building. But to place the building, I need to build a solid platform for that. The story should have the placement so that the building stands on top of it.
Hmm.
But as a story, for me, it is a story of two freedom fighters. So how do I bring in a mass dance number like this into the story?
Yeah.
The story doesn't care about what the audience wants. The story has to have a beginning, has a middle, at the end. It should flow in on its own.
Yeah.
So it is very essential for me to make that go seamlessly, that dance sequence go seamlessly into the story.
Mm.
So in my mind, what we thought is like, it is not a dance, it is a fight.
Okay.
It is a competition. Beam is trying to get to Mali. To get to Mali, he has to go through Jenny.
Yeah.
For that, he has to befriend her. He's trying to befriend her. For that, he takes the help of his friend. They go to a party to get close to Jenny. But they are humiliated by the people.
Yep.
And in the process of taking a revenge on that people, we go into a dance number.
Mm.
So it is a mini story by itself within the story. And essentially, in our mind, we are shooting a fight sequence. It's a competition.
Okay.
Taking revenge on a guy who humiliated Beam.
Mm.
So that's how we brought it into the system.
Because even within the system, it's still this centerpiece on its own. And, you know, the music video has been watched millions of times on YouTube and everything. I mean, it's also fun that you mentioned the actors. I was reading how you got them both together. I was reading that you invited them both separately to read for projects and almost tricked them into meeting each other. Is that the case? Is that what happened? Can you tell the story?
Yeah. Incidentally, both of them are good friends.
Okay.
They know each other. So if I call one person or invite one person and say, hey, Tarak, I have an idea that I want to work with you and Charan. Charan. Before I can talk to Charan, I'm sure he would call Charan and give him a heads up.
Yeah.
And vice versa, it will happen with Charan. If I talk to Charan, even before I can talk to Tarak, Charan will intimate Tarak. So I want both of them to learn at the same time. So without telling them anything, I just invited them over to my house and Tarak came first. We were chit-chatting and Charan came and they were surprised to see each other at my place. I said, hi, bro. And we started. So they were completely at loss. They didn't know what was happening.
That's
and I said, see, I have an idea and I want to tell you both at the same time that I want to work with a multi-starter with you guys both. And he said, yes, absolutely yes, without knowing what the story is, without knowing what I intended to, because we have a great relation, they said yes.
I mean, in my head, it's like that bridge scene where they kind of look at each other, raise hands, and then they just know that they're doing it.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, you've also spoken recently and kind of confirmed that you're looking to do an RRR sequel potentially, because this movie is about historical figures. Would you be looking to bring back these two or explore new historical figures and introduce them to the world? What are you kind of looking for in and what makes an RRR story, do you think?
For me, one thing I was very clear, even though this story was based on the characters are real historical figures, the story is entirely fictional.
Yes.
We made quite clear about it. This is fictional, and even if you don't know, as you start watching the movie, you can know it is a fictional story. So I'm not looking at historical accuracies for this thing. And for me, it is a tale of friendship. Essentially, it is a tale of friendship. And for any successful film, we will look at the possibilities of continuing the story. We did the same way in the initial days of release.
Mm.
We had some good ideas, but not a great idea. Like, this has to be made into a part two. We never had that.
Mm.
Then recently, when I was discussing again with my father and my cousin, we are the core story writing team. My cousin suddenly came up with an absolutely amazing idea, which we thought like, wow, this has to be made into a story. And I asked my father to spread it out, to etch it down. And he's in the process of developing the story. It is about these two guys. RRR cannot be without Tarak and Charan.
Okay.
Maybe there will be other stories with other historical figures, which might be true or fiction. But that would be a completely different film altogether.
Yep.
But this RRR 2 will be about Ram and Bheem, essentially. But unless the story is completely written down, I wouldn't know how it will go forward.
And they're definitely friends this time as well. So I mean, you must be incredibly proud to have taken. I know that you talk about these historical figures being, you know, fantastical versions of them, but it's still introducing these people from your culture and history to the wider world. It must be incredibly gratifying, and you must be incredibly proud of what the film's achieved and everything like that.
Yes, I would say that. I must say we are humbled by what the film has achieved. And it's not just me, it is my whole team. We are essentially the same team we have been working for so long, not on this film, even the films before. It is almost the same team. And for the whole team to get this kind of recognition across the world is like both a very proud moment and a very humbling experience, which gives us a lot of energy to work on the future films with even more vigor and conviction. Definitely, yes. And yes, it is very, very gratifying.
There's a lot of talk about this film being put forward for the Oscars and perhaps going for even a Best Picture spot. Was that in your wildest dreams when making this, or has this come a surprise?
The success of the film in the West itself was not in my wildest dreams.
Wow.
Now, the campaign for BAFTA and Oscar is beyond the wildest dreams. Okay. And I have never done this before. I absolutely have no idea of how this is done. But the kind of adulation, love and support we had from the Western world, they started the tagline RRR for Oscars and RRR for BAFTA, and they started pushing it. Like, at one point of time, we felt like if we don't do this, then we are not repaying the kind of love and adulation that they had for the film. So it is mostly for the fans who are pushing us to do this campaign. And I'm absolutely loving it, learning so much so much about so many things.
Yeah,
we are so upbeat about this.
You know, with this adoration, with the Oscars campaign, with the BAFTA, your name feels like it's everywhere at the moment. Are you being approached for Kevin Feige for a Marvel movie or anything like that?
No, there are a lot of inquiries from Hollywood, but at present I'm committed to do a movie which I have already signed up.
Yep.
By Mahesh Babu. He's the big star in Telugu. So I'm committed to doing a film with him, but I would definitely like to learn so much from Hollywood, their style of working, their methodology of working, which I think I can learn a lot. I'm seeing how we can collaborate and make it a richer experience.
Right. Shall we move on then? It's time for adventuring with this.
Where in the world are we? Ethan, you brought the dog?
Sorry!
We are clearly in uncharted territory.
Whoa. Hello, you probably don't understand a word I'm saying.
Of course I understand you.
Huh? Dad?
Dad?
Grandpa?
I'm a grandpa.
What is this place?
The cliffs are alive. And the waters dissolve the flesh off your bones.
Everything down here is trying to kill us.
Okay, so this is Strange World, the latest animation for families from Disney. Neil, it's a bit of a bland title. What is the Strange World? Where are we going with this?
Well, we're going to a land called Avalonia, which is a perfectly pleasant place to live with fields and towns and people very happily. But it's surrounded by all sides by a mountain range, an impenetrable mountain range. So there are certain people, there's a character called Jager Clade, who is an adventurer who's desperate to find out what's on the other side of the mountains. So the movie starts with him and his rather timid son, Searcher, going off into the mountains to see what's on the other side and to kind of work out where Avalonia fits in the world. And along the way, they make a discovery, which is a plant that gives off an electrical current, a literal power plant that Searcher takes back and to Avalonia and revolutionizes them with this seemingly endless renewable energy source, while Jaeger determinedly goes off into the mountains and is not seen again until later in the story when the Searcher is called upon when this plant, Pando, it's called. There were very similarities to Wakanda and Vibranium in this particular plant that's giving Avalonia its energy, starts to falter a bit. So that's the point where they have to venture off into the strange world of the title, which turns out to be a underground land full of weird creatures, reminded me a bit of the land that King Kong goes back to in Godzilla versus Kong, in which very odd creatures with weird sort of tentacles and odd forms sort of coexist in this strange land. And the idea is they have to negotiate this to find out what is causing Pando to lose its power. And along the way, the father and son are reunited and a sort of generation gap adventure ensues.
Yes. And now the style of it is very sort of boy's own adventure. We have sort of a comic book sort of and boy's own style pages turning, and the animation is different from what we've seen before. But then there's also quite a lot of sort of CG animation that we have seen before. And the world, as you say, is very sort of organic looking, and sort of nothing really looks human. It's very sort of alien and globular. Did you like the look of this? And secondly, did you enjoy the actual story?
Well, when I was watching this, there is this tradition of Disney live action adventure goes back to the 50s to movies like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, In Search of the Castaways, The Island at the Top of the World, which combine these elements of H.G. Wells and Jules Verne with a sort of family narrative. And the idea is like, you know, save the world, preserve the family, and go to weird places under the sea or either the top of a mountain or into a desert island. So there is this kind of tradition that this movie fits into, only it's doing it in using computer animation to do it. Personally, I thought The Strange World looked a bit like a computer screensaver. There's an awful lot of kind of weird kind of things drifting around the screen, and it's all very kind of vibrant and colourful. But yeah, it does feel like they just plonked a camera in front of a computer on sleep mode. At the heart of it, there is a family story, a generational story. Basically, a Searcher, voiced by Jake Gyllenhaal, has a conflict with his adventurer dad, Jaeger, played by Dennis Quaid. And he has his own teenage son who he has his own kind of conflicts with. So it is a sense of bringing the family together. The mother does pop up at some point, but she's pretty peripheral to this. It's pretty much like a boy's own or father's own story. And it also comes with this very strong eco message about kind of preserving natural resources and being kind to the place you live in, which is obviously, you know, very topical and current and very on point at the moment. What I did feel that was peculiar about this particular Strange World is the amount of messaging that comes with it. There's messages about kind of about tolerance, because the youngest member of the Clay family is gay and has a boyfriend. And there is a message about ableism, that the family dog is missing a leg. There's messages about accepting the president of Avalonia just happens to be female. Nobody mentioned that at all. There is an awful lot of box ticking going on, I feel. And what is interesting is that this particular movie has a new logo for Disney. It's celebrating 100 years. It's a very fancy new logo. And the message is 100 years of wonder. And it feels almost like this film is kind of correcting, or an attempt to correct, 100 years of silence, because Disney has not been terribly progressive about commenting on social issues or on marginalized communities. And it feels like it's trying to do an awful lot of that all in one film, to the point that it becomes a little hard to ignore and a little heavy-handed. Maybe if they'd kind of spread some of this messaging over a number of films, it wouldn't feel quite so so didactic.
Yeah, there is a sort of sense of taking your medicine with this film, isn't there? You're right. It feels very much like, okay, I understand that message. Okay, got that. Yeah, got that memo. Thank you. And yeah, as you say, it is. It feels like it's a little bit atoning for, you know, some of the more recent things that Disney have been up to with the Bob that has been replaced this week by another Bob. They haven't come out covered in glory with their stance on LGBTQ plus rights. And so this feels very much like that they're trying to show that they do feel that they want to be inclusive about everything. And they do want to be part of a movement to save the world in an ecological fashion. And that we should all be mindful of not being colonizers, essentially. There's a colonial message in this as well, that you don't just go to another land and steal their things. But as you say, other films have sort of done this already with a far lighter hand. But then maybe the world does need messaging like that, because we are going to hell in a handcart. So it could be that, you know, maybe we do need that, Neil. You know, maybe viewers do need that sort of messaging to sort of start having productive discussions with their children. I don't know. What do you think?
It's the kind of film, I think, that is going to invite that dreaded word woke. It tries to say all the right things about all the right themes, which is nothing wrong in itself. And I admire its intentions. But the films that I mentioned before, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Search for the Castaways, were able to kind of instill a sense of wonder about the world around us, the glory of exploration and excitement and adventure, without hitting you over the head with a rather preachy message. The film does have some great visuals. There's a fun little amoeba character called Splat, who joins the youngest member of the Clay family and becomes...
Which somebody says immediately, "I'd like to merchandise you," in a ha ha ha, oh my goodness, do you think Disney will way?
It's a kind of Stitch character that sort of joins into this family adventure. And the ending of it, without giving too much away, is an unusual thing for Disney's. Closer to Terry Pratchett, I would say, in the way in which things are eventually resolved. Well, again, giving too much away. Jake Gyllenhaal is enjoyable as the sort of anxious dad. And the fact that his own dad is played by Dennis Quaid brings back memories of the days after tomorrow, another kind of eco-adventure in which they had the same roles. And if you stay to the end, as I do always do, being a complete film nerd, there's a fabulous little kind of jaunty song called Meet the Clades, mm-hmm. is like a sort of a theme tune for a TV series that isn't made, in which they sing about the clades. They fight fearsome traps and generation gaps. And it's a fun kind of encapsulation of the general themes of the film. And I think young audiences will be captivated to a certain extent because there's a lot going on. How much they're going to take away from this rather earnest proselytizing that comes with it, I don't really know.
But, you know, in terms of a good time out, is it worth your money down the cinema, or should you be waiting for this to come along to Disney Plus?
I was actually surprised when I was watching it. I was thinking that it was going to go straight to Disney Plus. I'm kind of curious that it's going into cinemas, particularly when there's a major football tournament going on, which is people are going to be more interested in the present. It will look perfectly at home and on Disney Plus when it arrives there, whenever it does, probably by time for Christmas. I mean, if you wanted to see it in the cinema, fine, but you could easily wait a couple of months and you'd have pretty much the same experience at home.
Yeah, it's not essential, is it? It's not, for me, as good as, you know, other Disney films that we've had in the last couple of years, even. And maybe it is because I feel like it's been made by a committee. But it is good to look at. And if you do want to escape the football and take the kids somewhere, it's not a bad afternoon out on a wet. It's going to be wet. I mean, it's been raining forever. So it's going to be a wet afternoon. Take them to the cinema to see this. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Strange World, it is out in cinemas on the big screen this Friday. Okay, it's time to do some investigative journalism now. It's this.
What is it exactly that we're looking at here?
These young women walked into what they all had reason to believe were business meetings.
I can still see it, the hotel room, the floor plan.
He kept trying to touch me.
I asked him to leave me alone.
Instead, they say he met them with threats and sexual demands.
I was young, scared.
Hi. We're from the New York Times. I believe he used to work for Harvey Weinstein.
This is She Said. So this is the story of the long-running, long-gestating New York Times investigation into wrongdoing in Hollywood, which led to the sort of downfall of Harvey Weinstein. Neil, tell us a little bit how they unfold this and unpack this.
Well, there again, there was a long tradition of films about investigative journalism and hardy journalists sort of looking into things and bringing power to account. And this fits very firmly in tradition of All the President's Men and Spotlight most recently. The focus of this is very much on the what's going on in Hollywood, particularly what's going on with Harvey Weinstein. But it puts it in the context, you know, it mentions Donald Trump and it mentions Bill O'Reilly from Fox News. So although Harvey Weinstein is the chief offender, he's certainly not the only one. And it focuses quite unusually on two female reporters played by Carey Mulligan and Zoe Kazan and the way that they cajole and coax and encourage the female victims of Harvey Weinstein to stick their heads over the parapet and tell the world what's happened to them in the hope that, that more people will come and do the same. And it leads up to the point in which The New York Times is ready to run its story, and we all know what happened as a result of that. It's a solid film, is what I'm going to call it. Oh. You know, yes, it's a film that does its job, and it does it with integrity, and it does it with earnestness, and it does it with sincerity. Does it do it with drama and excitement? Maybe not so much. It feels a bit like this could have worked as a sort of 10-part docudrama. The fact that it's in a single film, as well directed and well acted as it is, it doesn't quite have that the fireworks of it, probably because its focus being pretty much just on Hollywood and the entertainment industry. There's an element, slight element possibly, of navel gazing to it, as important as the revelations are. It feels like this was a something that affected much wider part of society, but it's pretty much focused on Harvey Weinstein, who is heard and is briefly seen from the back, but there is no one actually playing him. There are people who are in it who we recognize. Ashley Judd plays herself, and obviously she was very significant in the attempts to bring all these things to the public awareness. And a lot of different names of people are mentioned. Rose McGowan is another person who, again, we hear rather than see. It's a decent film with good intentions. It hasn't done terribly well in America in terms of the box office. And it does feel a little bit too recent. I mean, this the Harvey Weinstein affair is still going on. He is still facing numerous court cases, and he may end up having even more jail time to spend, you know, on top of the 20 odd years he's already been given. So it feels like this is the first take on recent history, and maybe there's a slightly more rounded and thought out version of it to come.
Totally disagree. I think the lack of fireworks is exactly what makes this so compelling and so true of investigative journalism. This is about the minutia, the plodding, the painstaking, the fact that nobody is meeting anyone in an underground car park to sort of listen to their deep throat conversations. You know, this is literally about two women who are juggling their own pressures as women, working women, which I loved that aspect as well. One of the journalists is experiencing postnatal depression. And that even is an element of sort of society's disregard for women's truth and the fact that women suffer with that and nobody really talks about it, the same as women suffer daily with sexual harassment, which is illustrated in a scene in a pub where a man refuses to back away even though they have shown no interest in him. So I think the sort of the context and the groundwork that it puts in here to show that this is not just Hollywood. This is when you go out and you go and have a conversation with your friend in a bar. This is when, you know, you're walking down the street in New York. This happens everywhere. Luckily, these two women work in the New York Times, which is a place that values women in the workplace and has a very strong sort of editorial leader in Patricia Clarkson and her great necklaces. Can we talk about the necklaces she wears in this film? Astonishingly good. But that aside, this is the very opposite to Strange World for me, in as much as, and not that they're remotely comparable, but that you are getting a sense of women's daily struggles with this without having it spoon-fed to you or forced down your throat. For me, I love seeing journalism depicted like this, where it's just months and weeks and years in this case. You know, we see a woman, you know, mature in her pregnancy and give birth to a baby, and that baby sort of grow within the time this investigation takes, to sort of see the due diligence that is required in a story like this. And I love the fact that within this, we also see the legal shenanigans and the hoops that have to be jumped through before printing that story. It's not just a case of finding your facts and knowing it's true and publish and be damned. The sort of very delicate negotiations you have to do with giving people the right to reply, the idea of have you done enough? Do you have the evidence? Can you stand it up in court? All of that I find really fascinating. And it's a massive testament, not only to the women who put their time into investigating this, but the women that stood up and allowed their names to be used in it. And I found it incredibly emotional and incredibly dramatically satisfying. I really felt that it really gave me a lot.
I love films about journalism too, and the minutiae of journalism. So I was wondering why this one didn't quite work for me. And I think a lot of the story is the fact that the New York Times is in competition with another expose that's going on at the New Yorker magazine, and they're kind of desperate to get theirs out first. And so there's a bit of a race about time. And I kind of felt that about the film. This wanted to be the first take on the Weinstein story, on the fall of Weinstein, and the sort of the birth of the Me Too movement, and all the changes, the vast majority of them positive, that have come as a result of this downfall of this obviously rather odious individual. I guess I think their need to be first has led them to maybe lose a little bit of filmmaking craft. The film does feel a bit of a trudge. There's a lot of kind of going up to doors and knocking them and having doors slammed in their face. There's a lot of kind of phone conversations. There's a lot of people saying, I can't possibly do that. And then later on they say, oh, okay, I will do it. It feels workmanlike. And I think if journalism is your profession, then you're going to appreciate the sort of the minutiae and the kind of nuts and bolts of putting a story together and getting to the point where you can say publish. But as a sort of dramatic experience, I felt that it was pretty much one note. And I didn't feel the sort of triumphant yes that you should really feel at the end of the story. That's just me, I guess. I think there are people who will have that and will kind of feel a sense of vindication at the end of it. I think they wanted to get this out now. They obviously wanted to get out in time for the awards season. Maybe if they just kept giving a bit more time to it, I think they would have come up with a slightly stronger result.
I did find it very cathartic, and I wept when the big emotional beat paid off towards the end of the film. And I think that's because it really did sort of manage to show how hard women were trying to open this up and take these allegations into the light, not just Weinstein, but in every area of business. And that if one said that they had experienced it, then other people come forward, which is essentially, you know, this the Me Too movement and the fact that, you know, that women refused to be silent anymore and this culture of fear that was going on to keep people silent. So I did feel that it's sort of that sort of ploddingness that you're talking about echoed that entire experience, that people stopped talking about it because nobody listened and nobody did anything about it, which is something that many characters say in this. You know, I told this person and nothing happened. So I felt like it reflected that accurately. And I think that's, you know, there's probably an element of they really wanted to do this right, because the women in this story had been treated so badly and had been done dirty for so many years that everything about this film had to be right. And therefore, maybe it isn't the bells and whistles and great explosions that you might want, but this is the truth of it and the veracity in it feels earned. So for me, I liked that slow burn, but I can see what you're saying.
And it's entirely possible, Jane, that I'm entirely the wrong gender to be talking about this film. And I accept that. But you can only speak as you find. This one, it really is a case of he said, she said. And
We're living it right here.
And if people go and see this movie and have conversations and want to find out more and want to do more, then this movie will have done its job.
Yes, indeed. And maybe the point of it isn't great box office. Maybe that's not the point. It's the point that audiences find it and maybe question themselves in their complicity or in, not speaking out, whatever it is. Maybe it does more as part of that movement than box office numbers. But anyway, if you would like to participate in the conversation that she said does evoke, it is in cinemas on Friday. Right, before we move on, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, The Last Picture Show. This is an occasional podcast where we ask people to pick four films they'd put on at a cinema if it was the last time they could watch them on a big screen. We've had loads of famous people on it. We've also had members of the team. And this week, we have Jordan Farley choosing his four films. They're all bleak, I'll tell you. There's no spoiler there. Jordan is a bleak person when it comes to films. But it's a really interesting listen. And so if you could find that and listen to it, we'd really appreciate it. You can find episodes on your podcast platform by searching for Total Films Last Picture Show. And here's a clip of Jordan being bleak with his choice.
Donnie Darko. I didn't understand a single thing in it, I don't think, but it definitely did blow my mind. Big science fiction fan, big mystery film fan. Loved the imagery of Frank the Bunny. Loved time travel. I just loved everything that I was hearing about it. And then when I eventually did see it, absolutely blew me away. One of those films where you just don't know what to make of it at all when you've seen it, because it's so confusing. It's almost overwhelming. Like, I had no idea to process what I'd just seen. On subsequent viewings, I've kind of unpicked it and I've read various things, so I feel like I know it quite well now, but at the time I was very unsure of what my thoughts were. I just knew deep down that it had really affected me, and I would have been 16 when I first saw it. I guess I would describe myself as quite an emo kid at that time. I was the stereotypical Nirvana obsessed teenager at that point. And Donnie Darko is just one of the most emo films ever made. So it just spoke to me on a deep level in that way.
Right, moving on. It's time to be a little bit naughty. It's this. When you grow
up. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was trapped. This is the story of her great escape.
Matilda, my name's Miss Honey.
Miss? It's hurting my head.
Is maths your favourite thing?
What I really like is reading. It's like a holiday in your head.
Your mind, Matilda. Your parents must think they've won the lottery with a child like you.
Oh, Yeah, they just love me at home. Do you want to hear about my first day at school?
Yeah, I'd rather eat vegetables.
Now get to bed, you little buttworm.
Okay, so Neil, this is Matilda, the famous Roald Dahl book that's been made into a film already, has been made into a stage show with Tim Mitchin, and now is the film of the stage show. Tell us a little bit about who Matilda is for those of us who have not read or seen anything about her.
Well, the full title of the film is Roald Dahl's Matilda, the musical, which reflects the fact, obviously, it started as a book that was then filmed by Danny DeVito, who relocated to America. Then it was turned into a stage musical by the Royal Shakespeare Company with music by Tim Minchin. And now it's the film of the stage show of the book. The story is largely unchanged. Matilda is a very bright, precocious, imaginative schoolgirl who has, up to this point in the story, has been raised at home by her horrible parents, played by Stephen Graham and Andrew Riseborough, who, after one sort of mischievous prank too many, pack her off to Cruncham Hall, this ghastly Dickensian school presided over by the formidable Miss Trunchbull, played by Emma Thompson. And obviously, there's not much love lost between Miss Trunchbull and Matilda, and it's a battle of wills over who can prevail. So it has charming elements to it. It's got great songs by Tim Minchin. It's very colourful. It's something kind of like, you know, pastel colours. And then when you go to Cruncham Hall, it's always very kind of dark and grim and dour. And it has Emma Thompson in complete scene-stealing, scenery-chewing form under a lot of prosthetics playing this very large and formidable Miss Trunchbull. For me, I absolutely adore the musical. I think it works wonders on stage, and it's a great night out at the theatre. This didn't feel terribly essential to me. It didn't feel that it was making great strides in terms of what adding things to the musical or even adding things to the story. It didn't feel like it was a film that particularly needed to be made, and I didn't feel that it really improved upon or made any great departures from the musical or even the story for which it's based. I think people will enjoy it, particularly if they haven't seen the show, and I think they'll enjoy the performances and the colours and the very and charming kids. For me, it didn't quite work.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you again, because it totally worked for me on every level. And I think I love the fact that it's taken this stage show and sort of put it on a screen at a price that people around the country can afford, because not everyone can afford to go to the theatre to see the stage show. It's expensive business, taking your entire brood to the West End or any other theatre. Cinema is, I mean, I'm not going to say it's a hugely cheap experience, but it's a less costly experience. And, you know, you can watch it time and time again without having spent thousands of pounds on theatre tickets. So for that point of view, I think it works brilliantly. I haven't seen the stage show. I didn't know the songs. I didn't know the songs at all when I went in. So for me, it was just going in completely cold. And they're so catchy, aren't they? I mean, I know people have already said this before. I'm not, you know, this is not breaking news that Matilda the musical is a catchy thing. But I just found them really catchy and really emotionally affecting. And the person you haven't mentioned who was the absolute heart of this for me is Miss Honey, played by Lashana Lynch, who is this gorgeous teacher at the school. And she exudes such goodness, such care, such love, and has been so hurt herself in her own life. And she has this one song that I was just blubbing. Like, I just was like, to the person next to me, do you have tissues? It was just got me. So I really, really enjoyed it. And the pastel colours worked for me, the sort of luridness of the parents, Stephen Graham's teeth, Andrea Riseborough. I'm not sure I've seen her as good in anything. I love her, but I think she's absolutely amazing in this. Liked her much better in this than Amsterdam, that's for sure. Better wig too. But yeah, I thought this was an absolute four quadrant crowd pleaser, absolute winner. Only a bar humbug would watch this and not like it. So that's what I'm saying about you, Neil.
Yeah, I feel as if I've been a bit Grinch-like throughout this podcast, and I should give myself a talking to, because this should be the film I would love. I mean, I adore the stage show, and there needs to be some kind of extra element. It can't just be a straight translation. When there are extra elements here, I don't think they're particularly wise. I mean, there's a lot of CGI towards the end. We should say that Matilda, as well as being very well read, has elements of telekinesis, Carrie again, that enable her to level the playing field between her and the rather sort of grumpy grown-ups that she's facing. I should love kids sort of like singing and dancing and kind of dancing down the halls of Crunchham Hall in kind of perfect sort of...
With such verve, you know, Neil. Such verve.
I just...
What's wrong with you? Your cold, black little heart.
I need to give myself a talking to. I really do. But for whatever reason, this didn't quite tick the boxes for me. Maybe I just felt it was a little bit too calculated. You know, we'll have some kind of some great Bugs Malone like kids. That'll work. We'll get Emma Thompson. She'll sort of like, you know, have this incredible larger-than-life performance. And we'll have kind of bright colours and we'll have balloons and fairground rides and we'll have everything will be very much in your face and colourful. And we've already got these great songs by Tim Minchin. It didn't feel like it was terribly organic. It felt like a concoction.
A little bit like Christopher Plummer, what he felt about The Sound of Music, and Julie Andrews, that he felt it was like being hit over the head with a Christmas card. I probably quoted that completely incorrectly, but you felt like you were being bludgeoned by a confetti cannon of sort of too much. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I was thinking of a recent translation of a musical.
Don't say West Side Story.
No, I'm not going to say West Side Story. I'm more surprisingly going to say Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which I thought
alone
did take a stage version and find a way of translating it to the cinema that made it different enough and fresh enough to actually give you a new experience. So yes, I guess we just have different tastes when it comes to musicals on film.
Yes, so we can agree to disagree, and I won't put some super glue in your hat or some green in your hair dye, and we'll agree to disagree, shall we? We'll let people decide for themselves, because Matilda is out in cinemas on Friday. I think people are going to flipping love it, and I think you'll be in the wrong and you should rewatch it. Anyway, shall we get on to our final film now? We're off to New York with this.
I haven't seen my son in almost a year.
Your son?
Yes. I need to bring him here. Very soon, I mean.
Always very soon.
The spirits have tried to warn you.
Do not
ignore the signs. You have yet paid me what I am owed.
You think Ash is just laying around?
I am a mother too.
I thought so.
I miss my country. Every day.
You're gonna be okay?
I wish I knew what's happening to me.
So this is Nanny, which I saw a long time ago at Sundance at the beginning of this year, and it's finally coming out. Tell us a little bit about it, Neil. Who is Nanny?
Well, the Nanny is a Senegalese immigrant called Aisha, played by Anna Diop, who has come to New York and is being employed to raise a wealthy couple's child, all while dreaming of bringing her own son over from her native country. And there's been so much in the papers about immigration and about people kind of crossing borders recently. And this film feels quite current in that respect. You know, it's got the idea of a woman being undocumented and being very powerless and open to exploitation. There are links there to what we were talking about with She Said. And there are elements of horror here. She is haunted by these sort of specters that seem to be warning her or kind of telling her that something dreadful and doom-laden is about to happen. So there are horror elements. We've been talking about horror earlier with Bones and All. It's directed by Nikiatu Dusu. It's her first feature. It premiered at Sundance this year and it was well-received, won a couple of prizes. And I saw it a long while ago and it stuck with me. The imagery and the themes and the sense of sort of mounting dread and unease about it has remained with me. And I feel it's a strong movie. It's out in cinemas this week. It's going to be on Prime Video in December. And I think it's absorbing and it's quite powerful, but in a rather sort of quiet and elusive way. You have to kind of winkle out its secrets and its eventual sort of resolution isn't one you necessarily see coming.
Yes. It's in that sort of genre of horror film where it's horror, like His House or any of those sort of other supernatural things that is ostensibly about that, but actually about something else and about trauma and how we perceive it, how we process it, and how that affects our lives. But equally, I feel that thing that's really interesting is this, and again, it does sort of chime with me too, is this idea of powerless that you mentioned, and the fact that the person who is actually taking advantage and abusing this young woman is another woman, and doing it in a play in from a place she feels is kindness and generosity, but is actually not at all. A woman who is very, very wealthy and has far more than her nanny, but doesn't pay her on time, and the sort of microaggressions that she visits upon her, which this woman has to just swallow because she has to be grateful in the situation that she's in as an undocumented worker. So I think the sort of the dynamics at work are really interesting here, but also this idea of this supernatural actually being a gut punch when you get to the end of what it actually means. It's really well done and an amazing debut here. Really assured. I can't wait to see what is the next down the line from here. Again, you know, I mentioned this last week, but it sort of reminded me of St. Maud in that idea that this filmmaker has burst on the scene with this really accomplished film that sticks to your skin when you've watched it. And like Waves before it, it sort of reminds me of that as well. It's not one that you'll forget easily.
It's taken its time to get here, but it has arrived at a point during the World Cup when issues about about migrant workers and the exploitation of people at the bottom of the financial pyramid is very much current. It does feel like it's speaking to that. It's a film that has a real sense of kind of like, you know, culture. I mean, the of West African folklore and tradition and mythology that the character has kind of brought with her. Her name is Aisha. It shares the name of another film that's doing the rounds at the moment, Letitia Wright playing another immigrant sort of locked in the British immigration system. So it's a film that, although it has kind of horror tropes, the real horrors it's documenting are the ones that we've just allowed to kind of happen and occur around us every day. We don't even kind of pay attention to it. Yeah, it's a film that stuck with me, and I think it's a film that will stuck with people who seek it out. And yeah, it's a terrific debut from a really striking new voice.
We agree on this. I mean, it's amazing. So we actually agree you should go and see this. So if you fancy Nanny, it is out in cinemas on Friday. And as you say, Neil, it is coming to Prime in December, so not long to wait. So if you don't catch it at cinemas, make sure you catch it, add it to your list. It's worth a look. Okay, so it's time now for Star Wars Wars. Last week, James argued for Boba Fett against Darth Vader, and you voted on Twitter. 82.6% of people said Vader ruled over Boba Fett, and so he returns to fight another day. So this week, Neil, who are you bringing to the table to fight Lord Vader?
A different kind of Star Wars character I am bringing. I am going with Yoda.
Master, moving stones around is one thing. This is totally different.
No different. Only different in your mind. You must unlearn what you have learned.
That is a tough one to beat.
You can't beat Vader with brute strength. And obviously he's got the entire empire behind him. But Yoda just has wisdom, and he has intuition, and he has hundreds of years of knowledge to draw on. And yeah, I mean, he's pretty good with the lightsaber himself, as you saw against Count Dooku in Attack of the Clones. He made short work of him. You know, he's got time on his side, and he can use all that kind of the knowledge and experience he's accrued over many millennia, and he can bring that to Vader. And he knows all of Vader's secrets. There's nothing that Vader knows or has done that Yoda hasn't done it first. And I think, you know, maybe the big surprises come in the smallest packages.
Yes, indeed. I find this very difficult to argue because, you know, I'd often argue against people that, you know, without Vader, there is no world for our characters to exist in. But equally, Vader's darkness has to have a lightness, and Yoda is that, this goodness and this hope that he has, and this, you know, determination that things cannot end this way, in the way that Vader is moving things, that he feels he has, you know, optimism for the fact that a new generation will come along and fight for the goodness in this universe. So yeah, I think I'm probably going to have to say, I think you're right. Also, Yoda, like, as a kid, just so cute. Who didn't want Yoda around, and who wouldn't have enjoyed seeing him in his little tree house with his little bowls of soup and that swamp, trying to raise your ship out of the swamp with, you know, just your force. I love him. I love him and his little pudgy hands and his little hairy ears. Lovely. Absolutely delightful. All right, I'm going to let you have it. I'm going to let you have it, but we will put it to a Twitter vote and we will see, because that is a tough call. Vader versus Yoda. Very good choice, Neil. I think you could win this one this week. I mean, Vader's prevailed for weeks, but I feel this could be the time that he actually loses something. And why not have it be the delightful little green man who we all adore? So do go to Twitter and let us know who is the better character, Vader or Yoda. Right, that's all we have time for. So it's time to say, please do subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy listening to it, because it makes it easier for you and it gives us a warm feeling. But before we go, we have time for a listener's question. And this is obviously with Matilda in mind. What Roald Dahl book should be made into a film?
Quite a few of them already have. I mean, you mentioned Matilda. There's been The Witches. There's been Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
There's one which hasn't been done, and I think they should do a film of Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator from 1972, the sequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is obviously has been filmed several times. It was filmed in 1971 with Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory. Then Tim Burton had a go in 2005. And
which
now
is wrong and unacceptable. There's only one Wonka, and that's Gene Wilder. And I say that to Timothée Chalamet as well, with his Wonka coming out. I'm worried, but carry on.
Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, I read around the same time as I read the first one. It's the one where Charlie's family go into space. They dock into a kind of orbiting space hotel that's been taken over by these shape-shifting aliens called the Vermicious Canids, who in one absolutely terrifying sequence, they contort their bodies into letters and they spell out the word SCRAM. And when I read that as a kid, it absolutely scared the bejesus out of me. If they were to do another Roald Dahl book and turn it into a film, it should be that one, Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator.
And you want that to be a dark version, so you want that to be like properly chilling.
Properly chilling. I want the Vermicious Canids to be as every bit as ghastly and as horrifying as they were when I read them as a kid. If you haven't read it, you haven't seen the illustration, the best way to describe them are kind of venomous, evil space turds who can kind of contort their bodies into anything. At one point, they even kind of link up to create a kind of chain to kind of hold the elevator from going away. I mean, and if you do that with all the kind of the wonders of special effects they have at the moment, you could create something really quite memorable.
I like it. I'm totally into it. Mine would be the Twits. I always enjoyed the Twits and the various foodstuffs that was in the beard. And I think you could make a really grim version of that also could be quite dark, because they're awful people. And I don't know who I'd cast. Who would look good with a giant beard full of food? It would have been Robbie Coltrane, but sadly we've lost him. So I don't know who I would cast now. But maybe it's against type, and maybe it's something like a Jason Momoa with a giant beard being disgusting. Who knows? But I think that would be a great one. So there you go, Hollywood. There's two ideas for you. You can send us our, like, cut. We'll have back-end points, right, Neil? That's what we'll take.
Yes. Yeah, I hope the lawyers are listening.
Cool. All right. So on that note, we should say goodbye. So say goodbye, and we will be back next week. Say goodbye, Neil.
Goodbye, Jane.
Goodbye, Neil. Ta-ta.
Feisty one you are.
What?
Feisty one you are.
Why are you talking like that?
It was Yoda from Star Wars.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pad of water. The subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met. That love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of
to be a little bit naughty.